Good afternoon. My name is Vincent Watkins. I'm the Executive Secretary for the Return to Flight Task Group. Welcome to our final public meeting. Let me begin by welcoming the public and press. Charts are available. Well, let's see, charts will be on the screen. No hard copies due to the time element. Meeting audio has been distributed via the internet and it's being recorded and available on our returntoflight.org website. Task group members are please reminded to use their microphone when speaking. Press once to turn off, I'd like to also advise task group members who are on telecon to mute their mics using star six. And Cy, I guess you're the only member that's on the telecon. Can you hear me loud and clear?
Take my mute off. Hello? Can you hear
me
loud and clear?
Okay, thank you, Cy.
Yeah, Vincent Geyer's on too.
Okay, thank you, Gary. For those members who are presenting, please refer to chart numbers by page numbers as you brief. And of course, visitors are reminded to please set cell phones and pagers to vibrate mode. And we recommend that there be no flash photography. I'm going to conduct an official roll call. We have with us today our co-chairman of the Return to Flight Task Group, Mr. Richard Covey. Ex officio, Mr. Jim Lloyd.
Here.
Representing the management panel as lead, Dr. Dan Crippen. Management panel members, Susan Livingston.
Here.
Dr. Walter Broadnax.
Here.
Tom Tate. And also on telecon is Mr. Gary Geyer. Representing the technical panel as lead, Mr. Joe Cozzopoli. Mr. Dick Coors. Dr. Chuck Daniel, and also on the telecon is Mr. Cy Rubenstein.
Here.
Representing the operations panel, as panel lead is Colonel Jim Adamson, Mrs. Christine Fox, Amy Donahue, Dr. Kathy Thornton, Lieutenant General Forrest McCartney. And are there any other task group members that are present or participating that I did not call names for? In that case, I'll turn it over to our co-chair, Mr. Richard Covey.
Thank you, Vincent. Let's see, the roll call you just took establishes a quorum for us to be able to conduct this meeting. I'd like to point that out. As I look out, I see there's a lot of the usual suspects out there, and welcome you to our public meeting. And I want to tell you that we apologize for the delay. As y'all know, the agency had conducted their design verification review on debris late last week. That generated data that we needed to complete some of our assessments. That work has been ongoing over the weekend and was finalized this morning so that we'd be prepared for a public meeting. And it took a little longer than we thought. So I apologize for the delay in the meeting, but hopefully we will proceed through this in good time with good discussion and deliberation, and you'll be able to see us render our final deliberations and assessments on the return to flight recommendations made by the Columbia Accident Investigation Board. I would remind you again that the charter of the Return to Flight Task Group is to deliver assessments to the NASA administrator on the 15 CABE return to flight recommendations relative to how the agency has done in their implementation of those recommendations. We also have a charter. In our charter is the ability to make other observations that are relevant to operational readiness and safety. And in the past, at our public deliberations, we have completed our assessments of 12 of the return to flight recommendations, plus an assessment of space shuttle program raising the bar action number 3 related to safe haven. So we have completed those prior. And we have 3 remaining CABE recommendations that we will complete our assessments on today. We are rapidly approaching major milestone on Wednesday of the Space Shuttle Program's flight readiness review. It's our intent, has been our intent, to be able to complete our assessments of those 15 CABE recommendations plus SSP3 prior to the flight readiness review so that we could deliver, at least in a summary form, a report out to the NASA administrator. And that report will be a record, basically a record of what we have publicly deliberated in the past and today. It's our intent to do that, and that's why we're meeting today and have rushed some of our task group panels in their fact-finding completion in order to be able to support this meeting today. It's important also to understand that the three open assessments that we have related to external tank debris, orbiter hardening, and inspection and repair of the TPS on orbit all come together in a common way. And that has been NASA's approach to an integrated risk assessment for the return to flight activities. They have structured an approach to looking at integrated risk, and it touches on all those areas, primarily based on the primary control for the hazard, which is elimination of critical debris. It goes on to the aspects of understanding the orbiter's ability to deal with debris, and then also with the ability to affect inspections and repair as envisioned by the CABE. I will tell you that these three technical and operational recommendations are the most demanding that the CABE brought to bear in their recommendations, and that the agency accepted when they said that the CABE recommendations would be implemented as presented. We believe the CABE knew that they were making very demanding recommendations, and you'll see a sense of that in the way that we have completed our assessments, in the way that we bring forward our recommendations for closure. With that, I'm going to turn the floor over to Joe Cuzzopoli, who will take us through technical panel recommendations.
Thank you, Dick. And I think we all hope that this is our last meeting. And as you said, this is the tough ones coming together. They all play together. They all involve each other. There's about 50 charts we're going to take you through. It's going to be about an hour or so that we'll be able to make our way through. I would want to say that from the tech panel side, Dick, we appreciate all the leadership you brought to us. We appreciate you and General Stafford's guidance, and hopefully that this will turn out to be a good report that we give the administrator. Cy Rubenstein will be the first to speak, and what we're going to do is go through, we're going to do 332 first up there on the chart, which says orbiter hardening. That's the start of the debris analysis that NASA went through. And then we're going to do the external tank shedding issue. And then we're going to turn it over to Kathy Thornton, who will do the TPS protection and inspection and repair 6.4.1. So that's the order we're going to take, a little bit different than it's on that chart. So with that in mind, Cy is in Phoenix. We woke him up at 4 o'clock this morning. He still hasn't been to bed. He normally doesn't go to bed until 4 o'clock anyway. So, Cy, are you awake?
Yes, sir, Joe. Can you hear me?
Yes, sir. Loud and clear. Why don't you take it from here?
I'm on page 8, and I'll go to page 9. On the orbiter hardening, The CAIB recommendation was to initiate a program designed to increase the orbiter's ability to sustain minor debris damage by measures such as improved impact resistance, RCC, and acreage tiles. And this program should determine the actual impact resistance of current materials and the effect of likely debris strikes. We, as we looked at this program, we felt that what they really meant was to develop a detailed plan for the overall hardening, short-term and long-term, including the testing and modeling, and then for the first orbit to return to flight, determine the actual impact resistance as best we could, and then second, to determine the effect of likely debris strikes. And what was implemented to date are the changes for return to flight. These are highlighted on the next chart, which is a little bit of an eye test, but on the charts in color, the charts in the blue, you can see sneak flows, front spar protection, then down below under the landing gear, main landing gear, corner void, forward RCS pout design, next blue one, and thicken the side windows to the same thickness as the front windows. All these four changes have been implemented in the vehicle, and they're getting ready for flight, and I think there are three of these spar protection panels that are in the process of being installed on 104. I want to point out a change that was made in the plan since we first saw it. Under the Phase 2 plan, which is in color green, light green, said main landing gear door perimeter tile material change in the final design phase. There's a change to that, and I'll discuss that on the next page. And under the yellow, where it says robust RCC, and the one above that in the Phase 3, not intended for the near term, heavy design work was done to assess potentials, but the conclusion of the program was they could not implement anything in the time frame necessary to support where the orbiter would terminate flight in 2010. On the next chart, on page 12, as I said, the Phase 2 projects done after the return to flight were to finish the front spar protection changes, but on the bottom is the one that was done to change to fix the main and landing gear doors. The decision was made by the program not to implement the main landing gear door redundant thermal barriers because the high risk of requiring significant door mechanism rework post-implementation of this modification. Instead, the updated Boeing rigidized Dash 18 tile will replace the current FRCI 12 and around the main landing gear perimeter. This tile is three times more resistant than the current Freaky 12 tiles. And the BR 18 tiles have been authorized by the program to be installed on all three vehicles. Their first installation awaits completion of certification, but Vehicle 105 will be the first to receive these tiles. Illustrate the change is on the next chart on page 13. The tiles with the blue dots, if you look at the forward-facing arrow, both on the orbiter side, which are the yellow with blue dots, and on the door side, which are the light blue with blue dots, and then along the bottom, which is the outboard side, will get changed out in the design process. The tiles in yellow on the inboard side of the door and the aft side of the door will get changed out if required by attrition. There are approximately 215 changes or so. This ends the hardware test program. And are there any questions from members of my panel?
I just want to point out the comment and just explore a little bit the idea that because of the change since the implementation plan was first devised for hardening the TPS, the president's program, which would lead to the space shuttle retiring in 2010, has overcome some of the phase three activities that would require a long design cycle and would have been beyond 2010 before they could have been implemented effectively. I think, is that the...
Yes, sir.
You
That's
said
right.
that, but I wanted to make sure, reemphasize that if that was the case. Okay.
That's correct. We're now moving on to the second part of this presentation, which is the determination of impact and damage tolerance. As we pointed out before, the windows, the side windows that were changed, were tested to meet the total debris environment, and it should be understood that the sides and the front six windows in total are all now the same thickness, and they meet the allowable. They meet the debris environment. The impact tolerance of tile and RCC were determined, tile specifically, by tests, since there are no true analytic models. We call CERT rigor equations, which are those equations which ensure that if the damage is below, that will detect the onset of damage, and then the depth calculations that are associated with them envelop 99% of the data, and CERT rigor means they'll meet the original certification requirements of the orbiter. CERT rigor equations for damage depth tolerance were developed from physics-based models for data for ice on tile, which is a little different process. Also developed were different damage depth equations that envelope 99% and 50% of the foam and ice test data for use in the end-to-end probabilistic risk analysis, which I'll discuss in the third part of this presentation. Damage maps, which define allowable damage, were developed from a series of linked models from cavity definition through aero heating, three-dimensional thermal models, and bond line temperature models, and stress and structural. These models are designed to support the work for on-ground assessments to determine damage tolerance, and forms of them are used in the in-flight assessment for the mission management team. That set is slightly less conservative than this set. Again, the foam damage map was produced for full certification rigor. The foam damage map also was produced at a 50% point for probabilistic assessment, and no ice damage map was produced. It was derived from the full service, the full rigor certification for tile by using a 50% reduction, which is greater than the 50% allowable chart. I'll show you those charts in a moment. The RCC impact tolerance was determined by a physics-based model that was verified by testing, a very sophisticated work, primarily because of the limitations on the availability of full panel material and the complication of testing the RCC. But the models were verified by test data. The foam and ice thresholds, which determine the onset of damage for RCC, was developed with full certification rigor. You have to understand the difference between tile and RCC, and the tile that the onset of damage sets a threshold and you still have considerable capability after damage occurs, whereas on the RCC, the onset of damage and damage capability are almost coincident. Additional to the full CERT rigor values, the mean and one sigma values were developed for further work. A total of the test summaries that was used to test both window tile and RCC foam and ice is summarized here. In addition, on chart 15, in addition to what's shown, a full documentation was made of all the test anomalies, which, as for people who are not familiar with, the test program started out with an early definition of what the allowable environment was meet, so we tested in many cases to higher than flight requirements. As we looked at that, some cases we had test failures that have all been recorded and categorized properly to make sure that they fit our database. On chart 16, next chart, the applicability of the foam impact tolerance curves, they apply for both the acreage and the special configuration tiles. You'll hear this word used again. Main landing gear doors, nose landing gear door, closeout panels, or so-called carrier panels, external tank door. The Fricke 12 and LI 2200, which form most of these doors, are two to three times larger compressive strengths than the LI 900 that was tested. And the compressive strength is what really allows or creates the depth of damage. The impact tolerance curves were derived for different types of debris, and the numbers or the symbols used there are for the debris that comes off the tank over a full range of impact angles and a full velocity range. Chart 17. As an example of what data was produced, this chart shows the allowable term for the onset of damage to tile. If you notice in the box, it says 0.8 times 0.67 times V star divided by 1.18. When you compute out those numbers, it's roughly half the number that was observed in tests that started damage. And this data, and you'll see this note along the way, was derived from the closeout package sent to us for this task. On page 18 are another example of that drives a depth of damage. And again, that was done to full certification rigor. And it's shown, for example, here because on chart 19, then this is used to determine a damage certification damage map for the underside of the orbiter. The orbiter is divided for calculation purposes into 31 zones, and the allowable depths are shown there. And these would allow the orbiter to meet its full certification requirements because it wouldn't violate any of the conditions that was used in the certification analysis. After that, on page 20, another set of computations was made to determine the depth allowable that would allow for safe return. And this was to be used only in the probabilistic analysis assessments. And typically here, the depth allowable is about three times the certification depth. On page 21, we've summarized the RCC impact tolerance thresholds, and you can see by test, and these for panels 10 to 12, and then to remind everybody, they're 1 to 22 on each side, but this is the highest heating panels. The initial test values are based, derived from Dyna and the test cases at 1494, and using conservative knockdown factors to account for material variation, the ability to detect damage that could cause, or the inability to detect slight damage that would still cause the lamination, knockdown was reduced, and a factor of 1.4 applied. So you can see the values used for allowable damage are approximately one-third the original defined damage. Corresponding by test data and analysis, information was done for the same thing on ice, although ice is much harder to define because the properties of the ice as they form up are built by the daily pressure, the temperature, the humidity, and you never know if in the laboratory you've modeled the actual ice that will fly. But based on panel tests and an attempt to understand ice properties, these were the numbers used. This set of data then was used to form, on page 22, you can see the three lines, the orbiter certification panel for this type of foam, and going back to 10 to 12 in the middle, that would be 492, and was used in the probabilistic assessments for a mean value of 976 and a deviation of 102. And so the minimum numbers are approximately 5 sigma away from the mean values assessment made. And it says again that the certification value represents a rational set of conservatism for this case. For the heavier foam, PDL, a similar set of numbers were derived on page 23. On page 24, in addition to the allowables, criteria was established for the wing inspection. And all types of RCC damage. The RCC damage is very difficult in that there are potential delaminations that occur under the surface that are not observable. And they can occur with or without coating loss, and they cannot be detected on orbit. So the current requirements for coating damages are that they not expose more than 020 to 038 substrate with associated delaminations. And that applies to the hot panels in red, zones 1 through 4. And also coating damage exposing substrate, no holes are allowed. In the green panels, coating damage to a 1-inch hole is allowed for 5, B, and 6. Another view of the wing leading edge is shown on page 25. When we talk about wing leading edge allowable, we really mean the damage tolerance in the hottest zone of the wing leading edge. It's right at the apex and sits between zones 3 and 4, a space of about 14 inches. Again, what's shown here is that it defines the areas in which no burn through allow and a 1-inch hole allowed, and which is that as we continue to evaluate this, there is some indication that the crack thickness, the crack widths, will be upgraded. But these are what's used for all assessments. I've come to the end of the section on what the allowables are. Are there any questions on this? Is that no?
I don't hear any questions yet, Cy.
Okay. I'll now move on to probably the toughest task that was done, is to use this data combined with tank data and try and assess what the effects of debris are on the orbiter. And what's used in this model is debris sources, which you have to understand their material properties, their installed geometry, the likely shape of the debris, the failure mechanism of how it is formed, and how it pops out of where it is in a divot or function like that, and what velocity it comes out with. The DTA inputs themselves, which then force that debris to impact the orbiter. You have to understand the aerodynamics about the combined vehicle set and the overall vehicle geometry. Now we talk about the debris transport environment, where it'll actually hit on the orbiter, if it does hit, the mass velocity, the angle it hits at, is the debris rotating, and then if it hits, what the element impact capabilities are, its material properties, installed geometry, impact tolerance, and damage tolerance. If you recall from the previous discussion, the impact tolerance and the damage tolerance of tile and RCC are the end of this process. And the front of this process is the unique work was done to determine how debris would flow. And this was, I think, a state-of-the-art process. I had never seen it done before. And this was applied on page 27 to the general areas of foam. The areas on the LH2 tank, what are the black areas, the LO2 tank, inner tank, essentially meet the worst-on-worst requirements. And when I say worst-on-worst, that means certification values of orbiter and data provided by the tank meet the full factor of safety required for flight. However, potential foam from what's called the manual spray areas, and you can see the bipod closeout, the LO2 PAL ram, LO2 LOX flang, the LO2 inner tank, and as I go around, were analyzed using different techniques. statistical techniques, and the ones in blue were enveloped by the ones by the other ones. Correspondingly, on page 28, there were cases where ice was the predominant debris, and shown here on the tank are the potential sources of ice. And I would point out, in the umbilical ice area, some of those cases cannot reach the orbiter RCC or windows. Back to the foam, if we looked at a vehicle in a plan view, you can see the work that was done, and this was summarizing the case for the ice frost ramp. And the overall assessment for this configuration was a probability of six potential critical hits over 1,000 missions. But two-thirds of those come from the special areas of the main landing gear and the nose gear and the ET, predominantly all from the main gear. And here the damage criteria was set to be very, very conservative. But it was important to understand that set. Now, later on, I'll give you another view of that. Next chart. I think I may have skipped a chart. This was 29. Now I'm on 30. Is that correct?
Yes, you're on page 30.
That now shows you the data for the locked flange. Here again, the overall assessment was four failures in 100 and 1,000 missions, but 95% of those coming from the same source as the main landing gear door. 31 is just a placeholder. The data is summarized in chart 32, which is the probability of exceeding the capability on foam on RCC. As you can see, the RCC likelihoods are very, very small for the ice frost ramps, the LOX spall ramp, the LOX flange, the LOX LH2 flange, and the LA2 flange for the nominal heating cases. Down below on the towel cases, the interface flange nominal case is about the worst one shown. This data does not include the special cases of the main landing gear doors and the other special configuration, as they are treated separately.
Cy, this is Susan Livingston. Are these mean probabilities?
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
The next area of concern that was evaluated amongst the whole set of cases, and I think there were something like 60 cases evaluated in detail, and I'm only picking a small set from the total, was the bipod foam area. The bipod, if you recall, was the proximate cause. Loss of bipod foam was the proximate cause of the vehicle loss. And it was removed, but there was some residual foam. If I go back to the picture on page 33, in and around the bipod joints, you can see there's some small amount of foam in that area. Next chart, back to 34. Analysis was done by Aerospace, who did all the foam analysis to show extremely high reliability, a low likelihood that this could impact it. The data was based on ET bipod data. And additional comparison will be made to the Aerospace statistical model by a Boeing model just to double-check that they're consistent and these numbers are reasonably accurate. But there's considerable margin in this area and says the modification worked fine.
Cy, when will those comparisons be made?
I'm not sure if they're scheduled to be complete before the flight date. Is Melise or Susie there or Chuck?
We don't know. We don't know, Cy.
Okay. Yeah, I don't think they'll be ready for FRR. Okay, and I don't think anybody thinks it's a high-risk area.
Okay, thank you.
On chart 35, another concern was bellows ice. The forward bellows was the reason, the changes in the forward bellows were the reason for the, that came out of the last design verification review and were the primary reason for the schedule delay. On page 36, that the heaters were applied to that bellows, and a qual test was performed to ensure that that would meet requirements. The ice buildup occurred only in a small area of the bellows, position something like 1/12 of the area. It did not bridge over the rain shields. A worst-on-worst analysis, the full certification was performed, and the results were that it met the residual ice would meet full certification requirements. Then bracket ice considerations were done, and ice, again, is probably the toughest problem because it's just hard to model its liberation characteristics and its timing characteristics. Ice that's released below three-quarter, about 0.35 Mach, has no way to get anywhere to bother anything other than really local. It won't affect anything, but ice that's potentially released later on the flight could affect some areas. So these areas were examined in detail. They were summarized as follows. The ice on RCC, again, shows from these two bracket areas very, very low probabilities of having a problem. And on the ice on tile, however, potential of damage for the bracket 1979 and for 1377 are reasonable numbers. Now, in reviewing this data post the presentation at DVR, it was a initial assessment that that these numbers were essentially conservative, but that's what was used. And I think the NASA is going back to relook at that to make sure that these numbers are properly conservative.
Si, hold it for a second.
Yes.
Just for clarification, since the May to the July slip on the schedule, the only work that's been done other than the analysis is the hardware. We put the heaters on, or NASA
right.
put the heaters on the bellows forward.
No changes have been made to the bracket.
Yeah, and Si, this is Susan Livingston. The data you're showing on this particular slide, it says based on the debris DVR on 624, this is still pretty, this is preliminary data, is it not still?
Yes.
I mean, NASA has not finalized the ice allowances, tolerances or allowances. Is that correct?
Anything that has to do with ice has some sensitivity to it because of the characteristics. They're going back and relooking at this. The initial response of the experts, the NASA experts at the DVR, was that it was overly conservative, but they've been tasked to go back and look at that, and I think that reexamination should be done to support FRR. Is that correct, Chuck?
Yeah, that's correct.
Okay. The last area that I looked at with respect to understanding the history of the overall orbiter, the chart on the left represents, again, this is from DVR data, represents the strike pattern of damage to the bottoms of the orbiter from all dimensions. And on the right is the larger impacts, an inch or more. And you can see a clustering of data of impacts around the ET doors, those two smaller doors in the aft of the vehicle. You might want to point them out there if you have a pointer. The concern there is the umbilicals are capable of having large ice formations based on flight history. And large ice observed in flight includes events like multi-tanking and raining during tank. Analysis sizes were used where large an oversized estimate of what could form, and are not representative of any typical formations. And they do exceed the bound of any of the tile damage models, so we're not be able to use any model we had. Furthermore, the environment of that region is very turbulent and hard to understand the full flow. Ice debris from any source has a transport mechanism of tile aft of station 2058. But there is no mechanism to transport that ice to the RCC or the windows. evaluation of the orbiter umbilicals themselves, and that's at the ET door, the other side of the connection. In the case, impact conditions potential of a max velocity of 300 feet per second, with most less than 200 feet per second, and with a full range of impact angles. And when the ice, when this region was developed and designed and developed, that the umbilical baggie, which was put on to protect against ice formation inside the door, does tear off at the requisite below the 0.35 Mach number and should not transport ice anywhere. Yet, indeed, we've seen ice observed. And we've corroborated the baggy turret function by in-flight pictures. So what's going to go on is, since there's no way to model this phenomena, to ensure that the launch criteria are updated to minimize any ice formation allowable in this area almost to the point of no ice.
Si?
Yes.
If we go back to chart 39 as a point of clarification, the impacts, first, there's an extraordinary number of impacts shown on the left chart.
That's almost 15,000.
How many?
15,000 over 100 plus flights, or about 150 a flight.
Okay, and that's ice and foam?
Everything.
Okay. That's everything that we've recorded that's impacted the underside.
And it's very hard to discern ice from foam, other than foam generally is a shallow damage. It could be greater than an inch. And ice is generally like a knife blade damage. And since it's denser than the foam material itself, will cut into it as opposed to break it off.
So difficult to tell the difference between the two from the standpoint of the way the damage looks after you re-enter, but have they tried to categorize the difference between the ice and the foam?
Yeah, they have a set of 300 of the faults out of the set there. They have full pictures after it. I don't have the exact number that are ice suspects versus pile suspects. You can see patterns also along the side that show a higher density, and that's also adjacent to the umbilical lines in the tank, which indicate there's some more ice coming off there. There was one case analyzed where ice came off and looked like it hit the SRB as well. So it's clear that there is some amount of ice that comes off, and the primary way of controlling it, other than the bellows, ice, is to minimize the allowable ice before liftoff.
Si, this is Chuck. I think there are two cases where the program has recorded ice hits that they've classified as near-miss hits, that is,
correct,
hits that could be potentially critical to the bird.
That was one over the antenna?
That's affirmative.
And then there was one other one. So it is an issue to be concerned with.
Si, just one other point. It's not a point of TPS, but if I remember, those ET doors in the back are made of beryllium. Is that right?
Yes. But you're always sensitive to damage that could cause a thermal barrier to pop up or some other thing that would keep a door from closing. So it is a sensitive area.
Yeah, the area around the closeout doors is classified as a zero-hit zone. That is, no hits are allowed.
I think the way they did the analysis was they said it's one-inch boundary, to give it some definition of.
Okay, let's go.
I've gone through chart.
I got a question in chart 40. That was where we took you back.
Yes.
What's the takeaway that we should get from your chart here?
It's essential to make sure the launch criteria and the launch controls ensure that. I don't know how to define no ice, but absolute minimize is formed in that umbilical area. Otherwise, it's a scrub.
Okay.
On page 41, I'd like to make it some...
Let's see, Si. What that says to me, Dick, is that the decision on the launch process will place very high value on what the ice inspection team sees when they go on the pad. And that this ice inspection team will come back, report to the management what they have seen. This is a common technique that's always been used. And that now that they understand the implications of this ice, there'll be great attention given to that. That's what I take away from that.
I would agree, Forrest.
But I think from what I'm hearing Si say and just, you know, just other information, it appears that this whole area, I mean, the ice is still a work in progress in terms of you know, the debris allowances and tolerances for in terms of ice. So much of what's been said here in revising the launch commit criteria really can't be concluded yet until some very fundamental decisions are made.
Yeah,
it's not completed.
That's what I understand, too.
A fair amount has been done, but it's not complete.
Yeah, that's what I understand, too, Susan. But, you know, I guess the thing that I gathered out of this is that they've always paid attention to ice. Now they understand the implications of it better than they have before, and now they will pay extra attention to ice.
Well, I sat in the control room on the first flight, and the rule was no ice. We didn't know what it would do. We've learned quite a bit in the 120 flights since.
And, Si, I think the NESC has accepted an independent action to go back and look at the umbilicals or bring that back before flight.
Right.
Si, this is Dan. While we're at the point of NESC, what's the status of their review of the models employed here?
I think they've reviewed the individual models, but not the end-to-end set that are used for on-orbit verification or on-orbit assessments. And I think they're in process on all the ice stuff. But they have been running an inline review with the orbiter and the tank project to make sure that they feed back their comments. But I think they still have some remaining work on ice and the on-orbit support end-to-end. I think the work on the damage models allowable for foam are fairly well through. And the damage models based on testing of hardware is through.
But the pre-flight models have been validated.
Pre-flight, yes, but not in-flight. And there's some residual work on some special cases for ice. It's a very tough area, as you're aware of, Dan. I'd like to go to chart 41. Is everybody in sync now? On chart 41, I just want to summarize what we said. The four hardware for changes for RTF are done and certified. The Phase 2 program has been updated and pointed out that the design approach for the main landing gear door thermal barriers has been changed, and the RCC program has been terminated due to the program changes. Although significant work was done on RCC, no solution was found that could meet the time schedule of 2010. The TPS impact test program is completed. The TPS certification statistical allowables were completed. Inspection criteria was updated. Damage model assessment were developed. And the historical database had an extreme intense review. I've only touched on a small part of it, but new tools were developed to support subsequent flights to categorize and to be able to retrieve information that defines damage. It was an extensive effort to develop techniques to assess likely debris effects, significantly better than we ever had before. The foam impacts are well understood. Ice impacts, not as well. And the ice formation inspection requirements are being updated. All statistical work I've showed you really are guides to support the final hazard analysis NASA's making. And the independent verification of models is still in process by the NASA Engineering and Safety group. On page 42 is the panel assessment, our tech panel assessment. Our assessment is the hardware program defined that supports RTF. The TPS impact resistance was supported by significant test analysis and did have independent peer review during its process.
The likelihood effects of debris is exceptionally complicated. The orbiter provided damage models for statistical work. The ET provided updated expected debris information. Ice formation was estimated and bounded. And again, the statistical estimates that result from that are really guides, hard to take as absolute numbers. And when all this is done, there's still a possibility of critical damage. From the viewpoint of the technical panel, NASA has conducted an extensive program to improve their understanding of the impact resistance of TPS and the likely effects of damage. And the major additions to this database will come as a result of vehicle flight test. On page 43, our recommendation to the task group was that we believe that the completion of the open work that's been discussed, with that completion, has demonstrated that they have met the intent of the CAIB recommendation. And that's the end of my presentation.
Dick, I would like to commend Dr. Daniels for his support to go in all these meetings that NASA run on the DVR and debris. And without him, MSI as a team put this all together, and I want to make sure everybody understands that Chuck's time was, a lot of time was put into this.
I got a question relative to this recommendation. I know we've been pressing to get the NASA officially signed off closure package to us. There was some question even earlier today as to whether we had that without changes as to what had been given in a draft form. What's the status of that?
I have not looked in the last 8 hours, so someone else has to answer it. I've looked at all the preliminary.
I think the answer's in a room here, Si. So.
On 321, I did get the signed-off version about 1 o'clock today. It had no change from last Saturday, but it wasn't 332. It was
332 we do not have.
I don't know, Vincent. I got.
Yes, I believe we have both of them.
Yeah. We have both of them.
Yeah, they
we
were
have both.
Both
I've
distributed.
Just seen one. Okay.
Okay, it was what we had before for us?
Yes, that's my understanding. As you know, I was pretty strong on making sure that we had an official NASA position on these two that we're considering. And I feel that block has been X'd, that we do have the official position, and what they've said is consistent with what they gave us as early data. So I'm very happy with that. I don't have any problems with it at all, Dave.
Does the staff have both those documents yet?
Maybe not here present, Joe, but we pass them out to each of the members. They should have them when they get back.
I didn't hear the response.
Yes, as a matter of fact, we need to probably fed or faxed it to you, Si, but the members were received copies, I think, at 1 o'clock. They received copies of 321 as well as 332 updated executive summary and Space Flight Leadership Council letter.
Mr. Chairman, Si, this is Susan Livingston on the line. If we could go back to, I guess it's slide 9 on the CABE intent on this particular, or the CABE wording, the recommendation on 9.
Yes.
I appreciate where the tech panel is coming from and the enormous amount of work that NASA has done in this particular arena, but I think when you're looking at the exact CABE recommendation, there's a couple of issues, and I think some of them have come to light as we've been discussing here. I guess I'm more comfortable with a possible approach, or would propose as a possible approach, that NASA has met the intent of this CABE recommendation in part. They certainly have initiated the program, and there's been a great deal of effort undertaken in terms of hardening on the hardware side. But there's a couple of areas here which kind of, I think, need to be recognized as still works in progress and need to be concluded, and therefore it's not really been demonstrated that they have fully meant the entire CABE intent in this recommendation. And some of those we've discussed, and I think one of those side briefed earlier that basically there is no long-term program for to develop a RCC hardening, and the CABE recommendation here specifically mentions both RCC and tile as an area that needs to be worked. I understand clearly that, you know, that now with the currently scheduled retirement in 2010, that was something that was undertaken after the K report was issued. But nonetheless, we, our charter here is to say NASA's complying or is not complying with the actual CABE intent in their report. So I think that the absence of a long-term program to develop RCC hardening, or the fact that that's now been dropped in phase three or appears to have been dropped, is an issue that we need to take a look at today. There also seems to be a great deal of open work still that needs to be completed in this particular arena. There's always going to be open work. I understand this is a very complex and very difficult endeavor, and that there's always work right up to actually you're going through, you know, through launch in some respects. But the kind of work we're discussing here, I think, is important to be concluded in terms of fulfilling that CABE intent. And that would be such things as there was a huge amount of emphasis on foam, but there has not been the finalization on the ice debris level in terms of tolerances and allowances. The NESC is undertaking a peer-to-peer independent review of the model validations and verifications. That has not yet been completed yet. I understand from those who attended the debris DVR or design verification review, and unfortunately I was not there, but there is a number of open work items that are rather critical to be concluded and need to be concluded as constraints to launch prior to 114. And then as of earlier today, I did not realize we had assigned our closure package, which was also just a concern, and I think that's very important to have. So I guess I would propose for discussion here this afternoon that rather, and Shannon, if we could go back to the last page of this presentation, rather than than actually saying that they've met the intent of CABE, it was demonstrated they've met the intent in CABE, that we revise that to read something on the order that that this task group finds that the intent of CABE has been met in part, but they have not, but it's not been demonstrated to be, have been fully met because of this open work out of the DVR, because of the lack of a long-term program to develop RCC hardening, and such things as the finalization of the ice debris allowables and tolerance levels, and the NESC validation, model validation. So I
I think the nuance of the difference between saying it's met the intent based upon open work is two things. One is you believe that open work is significant enough where we should say that in the absence of it, the full intent of the CABE recommendation hadn't been demonstrated to us as having been met. And then also the programmatic decision based upon the current expected lifetime of the shuttle to 2010 has precluded a longer-term program, or has led the program to a course of action that not to pursue additional RCC hardening techniques. That those two things says that not everything in the recommendation has been met.
That's correct.
Susan, I can support those words with the caveats that we add the mitigating factor that the decision has been made by the agency to retire the orbiter, and that's the factor which has led to the program deciding not to pursue the long-term plan.
On the RCC side?
Relative to the RCC, yes.
Right. No, and I think that fact needs to be just made very clear. I mean, the decision, you know, if it was a schedule and a budget probably decision, but it was also based within the time frame of the least known remaining shuttle life. But that was a decision made after the CABE report was issued, and the CABE did not.
I think it should be noted that the work was initiated, detailed design work was initiated. A significant number of attempts were made to try and come up with a solution. But once the program was, life was terminated, the activity was tapered off. It's not like they didn't do anything.
That's correct. I think from the standpoint of open work, there is a list of things that NASA has as a program, open items to be worked off, and they have a plan to go work those items off. It's just going to take a while to get there, and they may go up through FRR with those open work activities, but they do have a list of things, of actions. Is that correct, Chuck?
I think some of those actions go all the way out to
L-2 days
before flight.
Okay. In the past, we've approved, a recommendation that would come from the panel that would say, "Hey, we recommend that it's the assessment is the intent has been met." And we've had, some things that were plan standard work. Is this different than that from the standpoint of, is this non-standard work, or is it? Is that what might make a difference in Susan's mind?
That's the distinction I'm trying to make.
This is very focused work relating to understanding the nature of debris, the nature of debris flow, and the nature of debris impacts. Specifically, the CABE activity, the NESE activity related to the ET umbilicals is a very focused analysis on, independent analysis on the risk of those umbilicals and the ice forming there too.
And I think also, on both the CABE recommendation and then our own return to flight task group interpretation, before return to flight, we were saying that the actual impact resistance of current materials and the effect of debris strikes needed to be known. And the fact is, on the ice side, we are not there yet. And I think that's a very critical issue, and it's very difficult within the context, I think, of the CABE recommendation and its wording and our own interpretation to really say that the entire intent of the recommendation has been met. There's a great portion of it that has been, and I'm not trying to quibble here, but I'm trying to maintain consistency with the way the task group has dealt with other recommendations. If there was standard operating procedure work left ahead on them, then we were perfectly okay to close with the caveat that work was expected to be done. If it wasn't, we could reopen. In this case, we have some significant issues that are not standard work. These are very focused, specific CABE return to flight work that needs to be done, and therefore that's why I'm suggesting the alternative wording that I have, rather than meets CABE intent, that it's met it in part, but that has not been able to fully demonstrate that it's met it entirely because of these caveats that I mentioned earlier.
Is the work that remains in this area, is it, for lack of a better term, is it considered a constraint to launch by the program and the agency, the completion of it?
Yes. My understanding coming out of the DVR is that at DVR, the actions noted thereto are considered constraints to 114 launch.
And that's true as far as some of the model verification as well. Yeah. Some is planned for post-flight completion, but there are the ones defined for defined for pre-flight completion. So they're scheduled both pre and post.
Well, let's see. Could we say that the tests have all been completed? The database has been accepted. It is what it is. The analysis of what that means in the way of damage has been looked at by some people, and that they're now looking at it, with a check and a balance to make sure that they fully understand it, and that work is ongoing.
It's called refining.
Yeah, is that a reasonable look at this thing? It seems to me like we're saying that, if I understand it correctly, that the program office has pretty well completed their work on it, and the other agencies, such as the NESC, have been asked to take a look at it, independent look, to see what they can add to it or verify.
Can we go back to the chart?
I would say this is true, except in a very few cases, the analysis hasn't been. The assessment has to be made. Another assessment has to be made because the analysis was very limited, and that was the ET umbilical area.
And in the entire area of ice, there's very, very limited test data, and the program continues to do ice liberation testing and understand the dynamics of ice flow. And ice is a very environmentally specific type of phenomenon. It is very, very difficult to characterize ice as a homogeneous type of material. So they're struggling with this from a very limited data set.
One other thing I think the program will be involved in that NESC is doing is the end-to-end analysis, trying to look at the interrelationships of the many new models that they have to see how one feeds into another and what our kind of combined confidence might be in the numbers that come out.
Yeah, sure. I think that, Dan, is the dominant reason for that, is to make sure they can properly support on-orbit use-as-is decisions. Because the ones used on the ground are generally far more sophisticated and work off a certification database. But you're right as far as the end-to-end for on-orbit.
They haven't. I don't. Maybe you're correcting me. So I didn't think they had finished an end-to-end for even on the ground.
I don't think they're doing end-to-end in the same way. The end-to-end concern was the interface compatibility between all the models. Can they really support the flow? And is there some error that they're, you know, in an interface sense? I don't know that there's any end-to-end statistical runs being made other than what's done in Monte Carlo.
I thought that was one of NESC's 11 recommendations, but I may be wrong.
I thought they were dealing with the end-to-end on orbit, but I've checked that, and it doesn't really make a difference. I think it's open work.
The results of the DVR was a meeting that NASA had was that all the agencies that are the independent agencies as well as NASA agreed that they had a plan and they're going to proceed down the plan, the ICE plan, the foam plan, up through FRR and see where they stand at the FRR meeting. Is that correct, Chuck?
That's essentially correct. But at the DVR, the members of the DVR board were polled. And at the risk levels presented at the DVR board, the members of the DVR board voted to proceed to flight, or to FRR, then on to flight, based upon the data they had observed at the DVR.
One more chart back, please. I think what we're talking about is these bottom two line items here, or items, I think. Relative to ICE and the independent verification, is that the unfinished work we're really focusing on in addition to the actions that came out of the DVR?
There's two basic actions. One is an independent analysis of umbilical ICE by the NESC and the ET umbilical area. The other one is the independent V&V activities associated with confirming the foam model of and the ICE model being run against an independent set. Both of those things were actions that were taken coming out of the DVR.
But in terms of ICE specifically, I mean, at the current time, there is not a finalized standard for acceptable levels of ICE or definitions of between the densities of acceptable ICE, is there not? That's why I was saying that ICE is still very much a work in progress. And clearly is a critical debris source.
The program is formulating the criteria for assessment of ICE. ICE is a day of launch specific item driven by temperature, humidity, wind direction, degree of sunlight, a whole host of factors as constituting what ICE will develop on a given day. The two tanking tests that we've run with the 120 tank were both light ice days, resulting in very, very little ice formations. But it is difficult to do anything other than specify an inspection criteria for ice, which is documented, and they have an ice walk down team that then goes out and does a visual inspection on the vehicle on the day of launch and determines a go or no go.
There'll be some more discussions on ice coming up with Dick. Goes through the ET ICE debris status.
Yes, Chuck.
Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead, Christine.
Oh, I just was going to add into what you're just saying that that's the ICE formation inspection requirement. But I think that the point that Susan is making that I agree with is that the ICE impact assessments are still being refined, and that's work in progress. And until we really understand that, it's hard to know exactly what we're even looking at for inspection. And so that's part.
I'm not sure whether they will change it to any degree. The primary effort is to, other than the independent look at the ET umbilical, all the ICE modeling that's being done is where they are.
And what they've done is they, because of the limited data they've had, they've taken the impact data that they've gotten from the foam and used that as a pseudo indicator of ice. Now the foam produces a larger footprint than the ice does, but so it really results in a worst in indicator of what ice damage would do from a total volume of damage. But they've used this as a placeholder in their modeling.
Which all seems to underscore to me that ice is still a work in progress.
Except there won't be any change between now and flight as far as improving the models.
Well, that's a different issue in terms of whether or not they've fully met the CABE intent here in terms of helping define the actual impact resistance and effect of likely debris strikes. In the case of ice, I don't think we're there yet. That's what I'm proposing rather than stating that they've fully met the CABE intent. They've certainly met it in part, but they have not been able to demonstrate, because of some of the forward work that needs to be completed, that they have fully met the CABE intent in this recommendation.
Okay, so what are your words that you want to?
I'm writing some.
Okay, and you know, I guess I'm going to look to see if the technical panel will buy into a change in words. But something along the line of the Return to Flight Task Group believes that the intent of this CABE recommendation has been met in part, but has not been demonstrated to be fully met. I believe those are the words that you used, due to we need to get the right words relative to the plan for RCC.
Yeah, it's getting back to the chart that Cy had. I mean, basically, this CABE recommendation talks about both improving impact-resistant RCC and acreage tiles. There is no long-term program to further affect any additional work on RCC. It is what it is for the duration.
The long-term
of the
plan has been
canceled due to
right.
The fact
so that's
that
a better word. That better word than there
it's
is.
It's not canceled. It's the work has shown that they cannot meet the current constraints of time.
And the word I used was there's just a lack of a program.
How about the long-term plan does not support any hardening prior to the 2010 end of the line?
I'm not sure that they're to the point that they have a long-term plan. I think there's really lack of a program to affect long-term RCC.
That's not what I heard Cy say. I heard he said they started with the program.
They did have a Phase 3 plan, and the Phase 3 plan was an improved RCC. However, the development cycle on that was overcome by events when it was announced the intent to retire the Orbiter 2010.
I thought you said, Chuck, the development cycle is something like 3 to 5 years.
It is 3 to 5 years.
So it would, in theory, be possible. We don't know for sure. It probably was amazingly prudent to discontinue work, but not necessarily true that we couldn't have hardened RCC for the last 2 years or something.
As you know, there are things other than just the development cycle. There's also, on anything of development of this magnitude, there's the formulation of a RFP. There is a source board activity. There's a competition for that activity.
There's a design cycle.
There's
a certification cycle.
So there are other inline activities involved before you could get to a DDT&E activity, which are going to add to the life of this type of thing. So the program looked at that, and they looked at the amount of investment and return, and it was their determination that while it was possible to develop this thing, that there wasn't a return to do this thing within the remaining life of the program.
I don't disagree with that at all. As I said, it was probably a very prudent decision.
Okay, but we want to use that.
That's correct.
Yeah. relative to the DVR actions.
That's correct. I did not attend the DVR myself, and I have not seen the final listing of the work that came out of the work yet to be completed that came out of the DVR that was held on June 24th. But the kinds of issues that were bothering me as not just normal closure of before flight issues, but would be the NESC validation work that they're doing and peer review work on the models and the end-to-end contract is. Boeing and Aerospace have gone underway, but also the fact that we simply do not have a definitized, finalized ICE requirement or engineering control or tolerance level or an allowable level, and because of the lack of that, and we may have it for foam, but you cannot go in and say that we can actually go in and fulfill the full CABE intent here because we do not know the effect yet of those kinds of debris hits since we have not yet defined what the requirements are. So the wording I'd written down was, lack of a program to develop long-term RCC hardening and lack of completion of required open work as defined at 624 DVR, e.g. the finalization of ICE debris tolerance allowables and the NESC model validation. And then, of course, the other thing was resolved already was that we didn't have a signed-off closure report. But if that's been done today, then that takes that third concern away.
The only problem I have, Susan, is I think your definition of the open work stands, except I don't know how they're going to get any better definition of likely damage than what they've got based today. They do have a firm definition of what the inspection allowables are, but not what the impact damage might be because it's extremely difficult to test their model. They have done bounding tests.
And I understand that, and as we all know and have been agonizing, this is terribly complex stuff, and I understand that, but again, our charter was to assess the compliance with the CABE intent. We had the CABE report provided to us. They had specific wording in there. We did have our own interpretation of that CABE intent. In this specific instance, it says the program, this is CABE wording, the program should determine the actual impact resistance of current materials and the effect of likely debris strikes. And they have not been able to affect that yet with ICE. That's why I'm saying I'm not trying to take away from the achievements that have been made here by NASA, but there is a lot of very significant open work that was not able to be completed and may or may not be completed by return to flight. And I think that we need to reflect that in our deliberations and in our final report on this recommendation because in essence, they have met the CABE intent and the wording in part, but they have not met it in full.
Mr. Chairman, I believe that we've discussed this enough. There is a plan, again, that they're following to close out these items, these open items. I have no objections to wordings that Susan just mentioned. I think we ought to go with that as a task force recommendation. But the tech panel still stands with the fact that we believe it met the intent of the CABE recommendation. So with that in mind, let's take the task force agreement that there's more work to be done, including the RCC hardening, and let's go with her words and go forward.
We know this is where the tech panel was. They believe the open work, which is really the key thing here, other than the side issue in my mind of the RCC long-term plan, but open work, you believe is covered adequately this way, but because there are other people that feel it's significant enough and it's non-standard, that we can document that as we have not been able to show through, we haven't demonstrated the full intent's been met because of that open work. Is that right?
That's right.
Any other discussion relative to that?
Si, you okay with that?
Yes, sir.
Okay, then unless someone has an objection, I recommend that based on the closure package submitted by NASA, the technical panel's presentation, our deliberation, which modified the recommendation and assessment,